Welcome to Family Matters with Jill Igizi. We are going to be talking tonight with Brian. We have plenty of questions for Brian to cover, and I was just chatting with Brian until Michelle calls in. Welcome, Brian. How are you?
Still battling the PA wars, trying to save children.
And what's going on in Canada this week with parental alienation? Anything that you can tell us about that would be notable?
That would be notable every time you do get a breakthrough and you can save a child. It's notable, and you try and internalize the lessons from why that worked, both legally, practically, and therapeutically. And similarly, in cases where, and there are unfortunately still too many of them, the system or the parent just finally gives up, you have to do a debrief and try and figure out what didn't work and why, and what can be done about it in the next situation. It's still a work in progress, this social ill.
Hi, Brian and Jill.
Hi.
You know, I got a lot of requests from attorneys, and there's a theme which was surprising me from attorneys. And you may not, Brian, be the one to answer this, but I got like four people asking me, what is it that causes a parent to alienate another child with all of the information out there about how damaging it is?
That's a fascinating question, and it is one that you have to explore over the course of the case. There are different motivators for aligned parents. And to some extent, your strategy, both as the targeted parent, the lawyer advisor, the mental health advisor, is going to adjust based on your analysis of what's driving the aligned parent. The main thing is the commonality is they're really not going to hear moral lessons. They're not going to be able to understand the education that you could do given everything that's out there. Appeals to the children's needs are generally not going to work, because a parent who's actually capable of doing that is being driven by forces that are just not amenable to morality pleas or education. They really tend to only understand the use of power. They don't even respect authority, because most of your listeners have parenting court orders out. They could be interim, they could be final, and the aligned parent is just ignoring them. So the message is always given: if you're not complying, there's a court order, it's not in the best interest of the children, child needs both parents, on and on, and it falls on deaf ears. Why they do it, I'm happy to send, I have this whole slide deck that I'm doing the hospital tour here in Ontario, in terms of the diagnostic, but why they do it could be they're afraid of losing the child. They just can't contemplate sharing a child post-separation. Just out-and-out anger and retaliation against the other parent. financial reasons such as child support, they want to make sure they have the preponderance of the time. They have many, many motivators. So a common one that I see is a repartnering of the aligned parent with, you know, could be a late-in-life remarriage, and there's no children of that union because they're beyond the years that you'd want to have a kid. And so what happens is the children of the former marriage, the targeted children, get delivered notionally to the incoming spouse as the fruits of the new union, helps cement that. And then the other parent, the biological parent of the children, gets squeezed out because they're an existential threat to that new union. The psychodynamics of aligned parents are absolutely fascinating. Some of them are histrionic. Some of them have such a poor view of the targeted parent that in their own mind they're protecting the child. They have their own reality that we can't reach. They view the targeted parent as a danger, to them, and therefore the target parent must be a danger to their child. They're troubled people, and the tools to deal with them are slim to none. Even the DSM, the Bible of the Psychological Community, says that psychological disorders or personality disorders, that category, are immune to change. You're a fully baked adult, and you really can't tackle those. So they will begrudgingly, if a court will exercise its power, not admonish, not threaten, not, I'll see you back in a month and I better see some change, but actually demonstrate that they are, the court is more powerful than the aligned parent, they'll respond to that.
Brian, how do you deal with parents? And I talk to many, many parents every day, and even in my own situation, how do you deal with an alienator that remarries, sometimes almost immediately after divorce, and they marry someone who is either a consummate alienator or falls into the whole, I'm going to be in line with what you're doing and believe what you're saying and do what I need to do to make you love me more by participating in the alienation of these children, although they may not know that's what they're doing, but they certainly do contribute to that. How do you deal with that kind of situation when there is that new partner or wife or husband that is also contributing to the alienation?
That's a great question, Jill. It builds on the scenario that I mentioned in my previous comments. Not enough has been written about appropriate step-parent boundaries. There is some research out there. There's various books and guides. If you search Amazon or our Canadian equivalent, Indigo, on guidance for step-parents. But where a step-parent allows themselves to be called mom or dad by the child and observes the child not referring to the targeted parent as mom or dad, but instead by their first name, or interferes in the co-parenting dynamic between the two biological parents, you've got a real problem. The child's already triangulated into the mix between the two parents. Now the child then becomes triangulated into a broader dynamic, and you have role confusion. Who's my parent? And imagine if the other targeted parent has not repartnered. Well, then they're back to a stereotypical nuclear family in the one house with a mom and a stepdad, pseudo-dad. And what does that mean about dad alone in the other house? Mm-hmm. The children are very confused and are prone to get caught up in the role confusion that would result. So it's very important for the incoming partner to observe step-parent boundaries. We don't have enough guidance for step-parents out there. We also certainly don't have enough clinical literature yet about the impact, which is pervasive, of step-parents in PA.
And it's so bonding for them, for the new couple, to have an enemy.
It is yet another common cause, if you will, between the new couple. Now, imagine if, as I said, that new couple doesn't have their own children. Well, they're going everywhere with, say, the two biological children of the original marriage. And that's nice and normal, and we go as a family, and this is our family. So it some very careful messaging and behavior is required of step-parents to not even inadvertently create role confusion for the child.
Right. You know, Brian, and in the case that I testified in DeWitt County here in Illinois, it was a custody case where I was qualified as an expert in parental alienation. The scenario there was that the step-parent, the stepmother in this case, had come in and really taken over the role of mother and father in this child, in this alienated child's life, because the father really didn't want anything to do with the little girl. He just wanted to make sure that he had control over the situation. He went to work in St. Louis every day at 4 o'clock in the morning and didn't come home until 9 o'clock at night. So this child was essentially left with a stepmother to take over every parenting issue that occurred while he wasn't there. And she made sure that she was called mother, and that she took over every role that the biological mother had played in her life, at school, in church, and everywhere else. So I think what you're saying is extremely important about step-parents' roles in that step-child's life.
Yes, that's often a common problem.
It's pretty amazing that, you know, the initial question with all the literature and all the education that's out there, the two people would find each other and share the same corrupted belief system. That's, you know, I always say, how do people find each other? And I don't mean that there's any parallel to this, but Henry, the serial murderer, found Otis in the gas station. Within 5 minutes of meeting, they decided to go on a killing spree. I mean, people attract where they are, apparently. It's quite amazing to me. Anyway, we got a question from Helen from Kentucky. And this is an interesting question and kind of hard. She says the obvious cases of parental alienation are easy to prove. What, not so true, but she says this anyway. What does this expert recommend when dealing with the much more subtle forms of alienation that we see in many cases, but that are difficult from an evidentiary standpoint? This is an attorney and an accountant from Louisville.
Okay. Amy Baker and many others have published compendiums of the type of subtle manipulation of the children that this questioner is talking about. And an example just had it this week, is the aligned mother at the neutral transition points hugging the child as if they would never see each other again. So she's not saying dad's bad or make sure he feeds you, but the body language and the messaging and the scene and the commotion at the time of transition is by intent or effect or both, going to tell the child that this isn't a good thing, that the child's then going to, it's a parentified child, is going to worry about the emotional state of the mother, even for the 3 hours that the child's going to be away. And eventually it just developed to a point where the child would never leave the transition point with the father. So that's a classic nonverbal cue. And you'll find good compendiums of this. But where there's smoke, there's fire. Where you have these subtle manipulation tactics, there are the more common and overt tactics. For some reason, alienating parents can't resist making sure they're the only contact person on the school registration and emergency contact list. I don't know why it makes them feel good and in control, but you see that every single time. So if you dig hard enough, you'll be able to find enough on the overt behavior list as well. But when you're trying to establish a PA argument or a pathogenic parenting, which is Dr. Childress's terminology, a lot of judges want rhetoric-free trials these days. So parental manipulation, whatever you want to call it without using the acronyms. It's much more than the behavior. The behavior is one of the critical components. But you have to kind of establish the makeup of the aligned parent, what's driving that, the history of going from a bonded relationship to a non-bonded relationship, and when it happened and how it happened, and if there's no smoking gun or atom bomb event, then it's just not natural for a child to split or look at one parent as all good, one parent as all bad. It's not the way the child's mind works. So the behaviors is part of the diagnostic, but you're looking at all the players in the system and how it happened, the whole timeline, some of the communication tools. But at the end of the day, if the child's behavior is disproportionate to the asserted reasons why the child doesn't want a relationship at all or doesn't want a fulsome relationship with a formally bonded parent, if that, it's just disproportionate, and sometimes vastly so, you've basically made your case, because it's just not logical. So it's more of a holistic story that we have to prove in court, and the behaviors, the overt and the subtle parental behaviors, is an important part. It's kind of a necessary but not a sufficient part of proving your case.
Okay, Brian, I want to bring in a question from Margie in Colorado. What are the consequences to my children if no one intervenes nor presents the truth to these children and stays silent, as we have witnessed in the Penn State scandal? It seems like no one believes me when I have spoken out about how horrific the alienating parent is and has been to me and to my children.
Okay. This is actually a very important point for those cases where the child estrangement has gone on for years and one intervention after another has not worked, and the court is then left with the big decision: do we just kind of give up and leave it alone and hope that the child one day has an epiphany and say all kinds of nice things? I'm sure the child will reach out to you as they grow up, etc. Or do we tackle it and reverse custody until the child develops resilience to the aligned parents' tactics and is able to maintain healthy bonded relationships with both parents? And, you know, we would reintroduce the aligned parent through supervised access at first, and then expand it and monitor the child to see if there's regression or not. So it's the big decision. I've had some judges say, what's the least worse of those two decisions that I have to make? And it is for those not truly understanding what is happening internally in the child. It is very easy to fall prey to, and because they're being led in that direction by the counsel for the aligned parent and the aligned parent in testimony, look, this child's doing well in life, doing well in school, presentable, no major issues in the aligned parent's home, lots of friends, and doesn't have problems with anybody, just doesn't get along with targeted parent. So why are we going to upset this child's whole world in an effort to salvage that relationship? So there's that. And it's easy, if you don't understand what's going on inside the child, to fall prey to that. So why do we intervene? Amy Baker, again, has published some great research as to what is happening to these children and how damaged they become as young adults, looking back on the loss of a childhood with another parent and the guilt and the sense of loss when they finally have the emotional distance to reflect. Okay, so I'm going to have to, with apologies to our non-expert listeners, use a little bit of psychobabble. But here's what's going on in the child. They're in a fused mental state with the aligned parent where they cannot look at their other parent rationally. And that means they're going to be prone to dominant-submissive relationships in future. Secondly, they've learned that you don't invest in a relationship, all relationships, even with a parent that is supposed to be for a lifetime through thick and thin, are disposable. And we know that there's an intergenerational aspect to PA, and these children are prone to divorce and prone to troubled relationships. Next, they have impaired critical thinking skills. They are being fed what their attitudes should be instead of analyzing their actual experience. And so at a crucial time in the child's development where they are supposed to be developing this skill of assessing all the inputs that life gives us about a person, about an event, about an activity, and synthesizing it all, coming up with their own take on it, that skill set is not being developed because of this fused mental state that they're in. And I could go on and on and on, but this is actually a very interesting part of the research substantiating why you do intervene. More is needed, and it is in process. But you can go through 5 to 10 major developmental tasks of a child that are not happening in this state. So beneath the surface, there's major turmoil and self-loathing and fear of loss of the targeted parent. It's a false veneer, and the job of the mental health expert for the targeted parent or the court-appointed one and the targeted parent's lawyer is to get the judge to see that beneath that surface, this child is being ripped apart and doesn't have a healthy future ahead, and that it's emotional abuse, it's emotional harm.
How do you get a judge to have the patience to go beneath the surface? I mean, you know that these cases are not beloved by the judges for a lot of reasons, not the least of which how frustrating they are, how untreatable they are in the, you know, more advanced stages. How can you, you know, tell the lawyers, there's a lot of lawyers who are listening and looking for answers, to be willing to have the patience to hear about this? Because you're asking them to be Sherlock Holmes and not, you know, thin slice and just come to rapid conclusion.
Yeah, one would hope that they take the seriousness of their job to heart and say, I have to listen hard and think about this because I'm dealing with a child's life. Now, it doesn't take forever to develop what I'm saying if you have the right mental health expert assisting in the case, and you can draw on lots of previously reported cases where judges have adopted that type of expert advice to the court, and build on that. So, you know, one would hope that judges, and unfortunately, all too often, they just take the easy way out. You know, child seems to be doing well. Whatever, we got to hope. Now you got to tackle the hope. So here's maybe a more crass way to say what the task is. The lawyer for the targeted parent has to scare the judge that they, the last line of defense when everything else has been tried, become culpable in the ongoing mental abuse and emotional abuse of the child unless they step up. They're the child's last line of defense. And that if they leave it alone, focusing only on the surface veneer, then they need to take ownership of what Dr. Baker's research shows and what we know empirically to be the case. And let me share with our listeners a recent experience that I have from an ongoing case, so I'm not even going to tell you what city it's in. But the 16-year-old daughter, who is now back with mom, and who, it was about the most extreme set of alienation dynamics you could possibly imagine, so just assume that. And as she's now decompressing back with mom, because she had a falling out at dad and stepmother's house, and mom is quietly sitting at the foot of the bed each evening, letting her daughter just talk at her own pace. About 3 weeks into this, she said, "Thanks for not giving up on me." Now, the younger daughter, the 14-year-old, who maintained primary residence with mom but is totally conflicted every time she goes to the other house and has been acting out, and the former straight-A student who's now not doing well and skipping school, recently, because she's been placed temporarily with a relative, said, "I know I'm acting bad. I don't know why." Mm. Okay, so you can reach these kids. It's not gone. The love is still there. If there was bonding between the ages of 3 and 7, it's still there. But they're confused, they're trapped, they're conflicted, and they're not acting rationally. So you need to show the judge that they can be reached, and it isn't such trauma. What are we asking the court to do? Put them back with the parent who, by all accounts, they loved and had a loving relationship with. It's not with a stranger. It's not a foster home. So there's too much worry about that. You need some family support, some therapeutic support, and you need a non-contact period with the aligned parent. Kids are survivors. They then see the new reality. They still want their cell phone. They still want to go to their school. And they adjust, and they make do, and they slowly decompress, and you've got your child back. It's all, at this point, the judicial system needs to step up, reverse custody far more frequently. The word will get out, and aligned parents and lawyers for aligned parents will start to change their tune, because it'll be a realistic risk that custody will be reversed.
Michelle, how do you feel about that? I know you're doing the best that you can do with what you have to work with, but how do you feel about other family court judges and their ability to abide by what Brian is talking about right now?
Number one, I know so much less than the lawyers because I don't know what other judges do. But I do know that it's a very misunderstood concept. And one of the things that I hear at times is, well, the target parent hasn't been the right parent. So, of course, they're blaming the parent who does the homework and works the extra job and looks like the angel. So the setup is not beneficial to the targeted parent, in addition to which the target parent is often frustrated at the end of their rope, really at their wit's end. So when they do come to court, they're angry and they can spout out a litany of offenses, all of which may be true, but because of their anger, sometimes exaggerated because they're desperate to get the point across. And that is a throw out the baby with the bathwater too often. Presenting in court is really, really crucial. The judges always want to do what they think is best, and in alienation cases, sometimes what we do doesn't work. So there builds an aversion towards the case. It's hard to distinguish between things like oppositional disorder or anxiety in a child and have the patience to figure out that there's a pattern of alienation. It all gets to me, alienation and how people understand it is so over-inclusive erroneously that it takes a certain sophistication to have a toolbox to know the difference. Does that make sense?
Sure. Brian?
Very much so. It's very much so. It is. I'm always wondering what's going on in the judge's mind as this is playing out, and you have to know your judge as well. Some of the more recent appointees who maybe had exposure to more modern social sciences literature maybe saw some of these cases in their own practice.
Or, Brian, who have even had the experience in their personal life.
Well, that too. That's not a fun way to earn your stripes. So
no.
One would hope that an attorney ultimately appointed a judge has seen many of these cases and therefore comes to the bench armed with a level of understanding. Maybe the regional registrars have to make certain who they appoint to do these particular trials.
Yeah, well, that's in a perfect world.
Right.
Yeah.
But, it's, for me, I have, my agenda is not different than Jill's, but this is kind of how Jill and I came together. In my opinion, the adversarial system, and I believe it's the Johnson study that says there's like in 80% of all cases there's some alienation, and it's pretty effective, not the extreme, not the red zone that Burnett talks about. But I think that without the shared parenting paradigm and the blame-based system, you get this on milder levels. And then Jill came and I was trying to figure out how to minimize it on all the milder, the majority of the cases. But really, there's a little bit of this going on way too often everywhere. And one of my top agendas is to get rid of the majority subtle forms.
Okay, we've got a lot of questions we need to get to, and some of them are very personal. Brian, before I go into the kind of personal situations that people have written about, I want to ask you, Mike from Bloomington, Illinois, has a question. What would Brian recommend in terms of court case strategies, such as questioning the step-parent, interrogatories, bringing that alienating parent-partner, step-parent into court as part of the alienation case?
Well, I certainly believe it's called different things in different jurisdictions. In Ontario, it's called pretrial questioning in the family law context, or examination for discovery in the civil law context. But getting them in a court reporter's office and asking them about what you think they're doing and what they're not doing is extremely helpful in helping prepare for the trial, in trapping them and exposing them. So that's on my list of mandatory steps wherever possible in these cases. In terms of the step parent, you're probably not going to call them as a witness. Odds are it'll be the line parent would call them as a witness, or sometimes they just want to leave them out and insulate them. It doesn't really matter, because ultimately it is the biological parent who is responsible for protecting the child's relationship with the targeted parent. It's a catch-22 that the trustee for the child's right to a healthy relationship with the other parent is the very parent who's doing the undermining. So generally, I'm not looking to summons the other side's new partner. I want to hold the actual biological parent responsible for the environment in their home and any role confusion, that type of thing. So those are, I think, answers to part of, at least part of the question that was asked.
Okay. Here's another one. Stephen says, Brian, many parents who are cut off from communications with children and have exhausted court resources turn to the internet to express love for their children, outrage for the system, and sunlight on the problem. What should they know about their First Amendment rights while stalked by those who seek reason to terminate their parental rights?
Okay, now you've got various aspects of U.S. law there that are different in Canada, because we're behind you guys in that you guys have a constitutional right, as I understand it, to parent, to experience the joys of parenting, to watch your parenting efforts bear fruit, and we don't have that in Canada. It's just strictly about the best interests of the child. So it may amount to the same thing at the end of the day, but we have to be careful with our language, because there is no such thing as parental rights, so to speak, in the same sense that you have it. So I think I may be getting off the questioner's topic just a little bit, but I think that if you start from the premise that most jurisdictions have built in a presumption that children are going to be healthier if they have fulsome relationships with both parents. Certainly the mental health world is absolutely united on that point, in as much as it may be divided on the is PA a syndrome or not. And the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child says that children have a right to know and experience both of their parents. It does not say children have a right not to know their parents. So you often see the UN Convention being used by those of the political persuasion that they don't want to see PA get recognition, and it's all about children's rights and the voice of the child, but that's not what the UN Convention says.
Okay, we have a question from a mother from San Diego. She asks, how does an alienated mother, this is kind of a good question, enlighten the minds of her siblings as to the truth of the mafia tactics of the aligned parent, and that my three children are scared of their abuser father and what alienated children are experiencing? They treat me less than, and think how in some way I, the alienated mother, must be to blame. Now, I don't know about the mafia tactics and all of that, but maybe, but I think it's a really good question.
It's a great question.
Sometimes, though, I think the mafia even acts better than
that's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we can blame them.
Yeah, the mafia has some internal code of conduct, and alienating parents seem to have no code of conduct whatsoever. But your listener is expressing is still probably the biggest problem we face in terms of public acceptance of this major social ill, is that when people hear this for the first time and they've had no other exposure, their first reaction is to say, wow, what must you have done to cause your child to be that estranged from you? Whereas people who have seen this, heard of it, maybe done a little reading, the first reaction is likely to be, oh, you've got an alienation situation going on. And so we're not there yet, because as much as these listeners and their friends are cognizant of this, the vast majority of people out there have never heard of this before. And the vast majority of targeted parents don't even know the acronym when it's first happening to them. They're just in shock that all of a sudden a bonded relationship with a child is destroyed. I've seen it happen within a month. You go from pure love to pure hate in a month. And you're just in shock. And then all of a sudden, one day, thank God for the internet, you're surfing and looking, and you come across this term, parental alienation. And it leads to this major epiphany that you're not alone, that there are people out there studying it and writing about it and litigating it and trying to solve it. And it is almost liberating for these people when they first find out that they're not alone. But it is not as pervasively even known, let alone understood. So for this particular questioner, how do you get your siblings on side so that they understand that you didn't cause this? You need their support. You got to call on their support. Give them some of the, you know, some of the basic articles. They're not going to invest too much time, so that, or give them Dr. Warshak's book or Dr. Darnall's book, and have them flip through it, because you need their support. And they can't really support you if they don't understand your reality. So don't automatically assume that your support system and support network is going to understand this. You may need to educate them a bit so that they can then be the support that you were counting on.
Brian, I know the answer to this, but can you just explain to our audience, and maybe for some newly alienated parents or for people who are just experiencing the early stages, how important it is to have a support system? And it may not be your family. They may be on the other side of you. So how important is it to gather people around you that maybe don't share in your beliefs about the alienator, but at least are going to shore you up when you're feeling like there is no more for you?
I just don't know how someone can go through this alone. It is completely disorienting. As Michelle said, ultimately a judge is going to try and assess the family dynamic, and the targeted parent is likely to be experiencing aspects of depression and post-traumatic shock and anger, frustration, financial fears, because the case is burning up money. So in my presentation, I have this one slide that says, we're too hard on targeted parents. We expect them to be at their best when they're likely to be at their worst. And this is when we're assessing them. So you must have a support system, a therapist that you can discuss this dynamic with, friends, join their support groups all over the place. PAO itself is a wealth of resources. It can really help to join. There's these ad hoc support groups in just about every city. If you do an appropriate internet search, go to the meetings, talk it out. People will have ideas and contacts, and it'll really buoy your spirits.
You're absolutely right. And yeah, you're right. Everywhere, I mean, now there are so many more resources than there were just 5 years ago, 8 years ago. To me, it's like the disability community, which has just leaped forward in the last 20 years. You know, we have come such a long way in parental alienation in the last 8 years. And if I would have known then what I know now, it might be a whole different ballgame. So everybody, I just challenge you, if you're going through this, get every resource, get every tool you can find to help you maneuver through this journey, because it's so important. If you're not going to be an advocate for yourself and your child, no one will. Nobody's going to do it better than you can. Okay, there, I've said my piece. I'll get down off this box. And I will go to the next question. Brian, we have had, Michelle and I have had David Goldman on the show, of course, talking about his international case with Brazil, and eventually he fought and he fought and he fought, and he stayed in the game and got his son back. I have a question about Japan, which seems to be a hotbed for harboring children who have been taken from the United States. So the question is this. PA is a big problem in Japan. The courts are here are very dysfunctional. Many times after divorce, one parent loses all contact with the child. The visitation after divorce is 4 hours per month. Most judges refuse to acknowledge parental alienation. Japan is the only G7 country that has a sole custody system where one parent makes all the decisions about the child's life. What advice do you have for parents like me who occasionally see their children once every 6 weeks but are unable to get the court, judge, or ex-spouse to see the benefit for two kids to have two loving parents?
Yeah, it's very tragic. There are certain cultures around the world that that just don't understand the level of contact necessary to maintain a bonded relationship. So the specific answer to the reader's question, it would be you ultimately have to get the child to become your voice for you. Keep it light. Just make every hour you have with the child precious. Share your life too. And subtly ask the child to see if you might meet for a lunch or a movie, and let the child try and maneuver that for you. And that's not putting a child in the middle. That's just, it takes time. Both parties have to invest time and emotional energy to make any relationship work. So you use the child that way. The other thing you can do, and this applies to even domestic listeners who have adult children, therefore the legal system is not going to do anything for you, you can use third parties who have some influence on the aligned parent, because the aligned parent values their opinion of them, or they're in a position of influence for various reasons, and you try and use them to pressure the aligned parent to sharing the child. Now, sharing the child is important for several reasons. Professor Ed Kruk at University of British Columbia has done some really important work on what is the minimum relationship in terms of time with a child required to survive the busy teenage years, where even in an intact family, you spend 5 minutes at a time in little bites here and there, because teenagers are teenagers and they have their homework and their friends are everything to them and they have their activities. So, but you're building on a lifetime of common events and experiences. So his research has shown that it's in and around 40% of the time for you not to be marginalized. We need more of that research so that on a social science level can explain both to those who might propose legislative solutions. Michelle had mentioned shared parenting.
Mm-hmm.
But also so that we could make the argument to a court to do something. But in terms of if you're living in Japan, those practical remedies are basically what you got.
And Spain. And I just want to say one thing about the mafia. I have to say this because I can't help myself. The original alienation in movies was Michael Corleone and Kay.
Sure.
Remember? He wouldn't let her see the children.
Right.
Yeah.
And when he did, she could see them like for a half an hour, and then he'd stay there and she'd be watched when she was with them. Anyway, so I have another question, and kind of interesting. This woman says that she wrote in from Maryland, my son, who has recently responded with the text revealing wanting to see me, Mom, I love you and I want to see you sometime, but you don't understand the situation. He's graduating from high school in May. Please address the best action. I want him to enjoy his day. Should I ask him if he wants me to come, or should I just attend as a quiet presence?
I would attend as a quiet presence because if you don't attend, you're going to hurt your child. You must message to your child that there's unconditional love and you want, these are lifetime memories. Secondly, if you don't attend, the aligned parent, even though they're happy you didn't attend, are going to turn around and tell the child that I guess you didn't care to even come to their graduation. So you don't create a scene, you have to lock eyes with the child so that they know you were there and that you're proud of them and wanted to share that moment. And you just stay quietly in the background, but make sure that you lock eyes, they know you were there, and they'll appreciate the fact that you didn't, you know, try and get up there front and center and run the risk of a scene with the aligned parent, with all children fear embarrassment. And they'll remember that you came.
Brian, Tammy from Washington asked this. When the courts have stripped you of all your finances and your dignity, no lawyer will even look at you. I have been pro se for 10 years and cannot afford to stay in the fight. Best I can do is wait until my 16-year-old son turns 18 and pray he comes and looks me up. I also know that time is my worst enemy. I have developed fibromyalgia and PTSD as a result of the trauma, and I have experienced an experience so that I can no longer walk into a courtroom without breaking down. What can parents like myself do whilst waiting that will be beneficial for the child?
You need to continue to try and experience the child's life through attending extracurricular activities and other things where at least you can participate passively. You need to do your best to have the child indirectly participate in your life so that that common bond of shared experience continues, and that can be through emails and letters, sharing pictures and other events in your life. And just the child needs to know they haven't lost you. Even though they pushed you away or the system pushed you away, deep down, every child's biggest fear is that of abandonment. And indeed, in Dr. Baker's research, when they interview all these young adults, they always say, always, I know I was pushing them away. I know I was to blame. But I really wish they had tried harder, that they hadn't listened to me.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time. And the example that I gave of an actual live case just proves it, that that's exactly what's going on. And so it's unfortunate life has dealt you a difficult situation, but your child's still alive, and my mom once told me, where there's life, there's hope. So You continue to message unconditional love, and then you seize that opportunity the minute the child starts to show some opening the door.
Terrific. Brian, I've got Ruthie on the line who is dying to ask you a question. She promises me it will be quick. Hello, Ruthie.
What I wanted to say was I'm on the opposite end. We just we started receiving emails from parents during the day, which I've been forwarding to Jill. It's been surprising that they were so awaiting your second coming to the show. We're so happy to have you. And I wanted to say that I'm on the opposite end of the Japan issue. It is a cultural situation, and we cannot force our American Western culture on Asian cultures. It's not going to happen. They've been in existence for thousands of years. The United States is only a couple hundred years old. We're not going to go and bully our way into you must do this, you must do that. It won't work. Look at the big thing in Brazil. We thought that would never happen. Do you realize that the fines today are anywhere from $100 to $1,000 per day for parental alienation violations? We never thought we'd see that in our lifetime, and it's happening. So It is progressing, but in Asia, it's going to be a lot slower.
Ruthie, thanks for the comment, and I'm going to let Brian comment on that. Thank you so much.
It's true that Brazil, after that whole incident and the embarrassment to them, went out and drafted the world's first national-level anti-PA law. Just a remarkable turnaround. And I forget the forum, but I was interviewed somewhere else, and the judge who wrote their law was interviewed right after me. So, you know, kudos to them. And in terms of the other cultures, it's true that there is sometimes a cultural issue. But I guess Dr. Childress would suggest that we're all human beings ultimately from the common ancestral genome, and we are hardwired to take in loving caregivers. And this predates any cultural differences. So on a genetic level, on a physical level, the more loving caregivers a child has, the healthier the child is going to be. So children are children, and I would like to think that no matter what the culture, there'll be a happier and healthier child. The more caregivers with different perspectives on life the child can benefit from.
Absolutely. Brian, you have been amazing once again, and I can't believe how an hour flies by. We could not believe, Michelle and I, how 4 hours flew by sitting with you in Chicago, because you are a wealth of knowledge and somebody that should have their own show, a television show, and be broadcasting internationally. We thank you so much. Michelle, you want to talk about who's going to be on next?
In 2 weeks, we're going to our topic is going to be parental alienation, visitation interference, and shared parenting for same-sex parents. We're going to have two attorneys on who are really prominent in this field, cutting edge, Richard Wilson and Rochelle Grimbaugh. So we hope you all join us, because the problems are both the same and unique. So we
will
look forward to that. Thank you, Brian. Thank you again, and we'll both be in touch with you.
We will.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
And remember, the best thing that can happen is that you reconnect with your children. The worst thing that can happen is that you never tried. So keep that in the back of your mind. And everybody, please, continue. Never, ever give up. Love you, Liz and Tom. Hope you hear this. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time. This was Family Matters. I'm Jill Ajeezy. Bye-bye.